Well, I think for those of you who don't know, I'm Dr. Rachel Baker, the coordinator for the Friends of the Cleveland Psychoanalytic Center. And we're supporting the good work of the center and trying to stimulate the minds of the community in various offerings. And one of them is a series of mini lectures, and our good friend Klaus Roy has been so generous as to give this lecture again about Beethoven. Of course, most of you know Klaus as the famous annotator of the Cleveland Orchestra for about 30, 35 years.
30 is enough.
30s. Besides this, you know, he's a composer and teacher and poetry writer at times and an all-rounded music and wit man, especially the wit. And of course, all this is in order to whet your appetite about Beethoven so that you will rush to your phones and call the orchestra box office, if you haven't done it yet, and buy a ticket for Richard Cogan's excellent concert and talk about Beethoven. For those of you who don't know yet, Richard Cogan is a psychiatrist and an excellent pianist that concertizes all over the world. Playing with Yo-Yo Ma at times, who used to be his buddy at Harvard. And this is a real treat when he discusses composers and how their psychic life gets expressed in their compositions. So, and of course, all this is to publicize the Cleveland Psychoanalytic Center and to support it. It's a fundraiser to support our work, our clinical work, and our training of clinicians. So I hope that by the end of this talk, if you haven't bought tickets yet, you will hurry up and get them. And with no further ado,
I'll give you
that. At Severance Hall, we once had a secretary to one of our conductors who referred to me in an official letter as the program agitator. It's true, I have it. Thank you, Rachel. As I said last time, I was grateful to Dr. Baker for not introducing me the way a club president introduced a speaker by saying, "We are so grateful to Dr. Jones for donating this lecture to us, because with the money we save, we can get better speakers next year." As you can see from this walker and the cane and everything else, I am somewhat disabled. The plain dealer usually hyphenates that as disabled. I love that. The only thing I have in common with the new Browns quarterback, Trent Dilfer, is a very sore knee. I surely would like to share his salary, however. My right knee is not broken, but badly bruised after a fall. As the proverb says, time wounds all heals. I quite agree. Can only hope that the correct version of the proverb will eventually prevail. Allow me to begin appropriately for this gathering with a little free association. Next year, in January of 2006, we shall celebrate the 250th anniversary of Mozart's birth. We'll be happily drowning in his music all year. Now, if Mozart, who died just short of 36, had lived to be 71, not an unreasonable age, he could have attended Beethoven's funeral in March of 1827. Why is music 200 years in the past so much in our present, and perhaps also in our future? These men speak to us as if they were our contemporaries, as if we knew them personally. In fact, we do. their gifts to us have brought them into our homes, our lives, our very souls. The arts do not live in a vacuum. Bach was born in 1685 in German lands devastated by the 30 Years' War. Haydn and Beethoven lived and worked during the Napoleonic Wars, which reached Vienna in 1809. The French bombardment of the city frightened its people, who could not have known what would strike them from all sides less than 150 years later in World War II. Haydn was then 77 and soon to die. He tried to comfort the many friends who cared for him. "Children," he said, "do not fear. Where Haydn is, no harm can befall you." The martial sounds of the time found their artistic echo, among others, in Beethoven's Emperor Concerto of 1809, optimistically, defiantly. A few years later, he even wrote a battle symphony called Wellington's Victory. It was at the time of the Seventh Symphony. In the last century, the great masters of music lived through two world wars, the experience of which is etched in much of their work. We think of Stravinsky, Bartok, Hindemith, Prokofiev, Shostakovich, Messiaen, Schoenberg, Webern, who was shot to death by mistake at the hands of an overeager American soldier, and many others. And now, after two major hurricanes in a row, which demonstrated our weakness before the mindless fury of nature, we still stand, wherever we are, whatever we do, in the shadow of one of the great disasters to befall our nation. And it was made worse by incompetence and lack of foresight, as you have widely heard. So as we gather here to think of music and art and beauty, we know that there may be more catastrophes to come. Who remembers without a shudder that World War I was called, once exhaustion had set in, the war to end war? What history tells us, in the long view, after all the madness and stupidity and delusion, after one civilization after another has come and gone, ultimately, only the arts survive. In his great book and TV series, Dr. J. Brunofsky, author of The Ascent of Man, said, "Every animal leaves traces of what it was. Only mankind leaves traces of what it created." So today, Beethoven's work is much more alive for us than that, let's say, of his contemporary Napoleon, which left half the world of his own time in flames. What brings us closest to the prehistoric cavemen and women? Their astonishing art on cavern walls. What do we know about the ancient Scythians? Their gold jewelry. Ancient Greece doesn't mean to us a crowded and polluted capital city, but an age of unparalleled achievement in architecture, sculpture, ceramics, and literature. How we wish that we could hear the music of ancient Greece, which must have been magnificent. In Egypt, we don't think of Cairo and Mubarak, but we think of Luxor and Karnak and King Tut's golden horde. The Maya of Central America are long gone, along with their unspeakable blood sacrifices. But they left us their fantastic temples, observatories, and art. Among the first people to return to New Orleans were the musicians, to sing and to play again. A recent Frontline program on PBS was called Faith and Doubt at Ground Zero. I hope you saw it. It was first shown in 2002. Very appropriately, it dealt at this disaster time with the spiritual shock of 9/11, a man-made catastrophe. And soon a similar program will have to deal with the nature-made disasters of hurricanes Katrina and Rita. But what makes the Frontline program so especially relevant to us is that it was superbly underlined by great memorial music, by Schubert, Chopin, Dvorak, and the Adagio for Strings by Samuel Barber. But the first music to be heard was the beginning of Beethoven's late string quartet in C-sharp minor, opus 131. Remarkable choice of music to begin with. Now, to attempt to sum up the life and work of Beethoven, a creative artist of unbelievable stature, is really an untenable proposition. You can give a one-year course on Beethoven. You can create a 20-segment lecture that is currently available on records. A good friend sent it to me the other day. But to do justice to such a life work in an hour or so is a challenge that can only be met with disclaimers and apologies. Why is that so? Well, first of all, you have a life of great complexity to deal with. There are personal and psychological factors that would need insights that can't be simply summarized. And most of all, there is a body of work which can't be looked at as if it were a mountain, seen as an entity from below. The music which has been a major part of our cultural heritage, some 180 years after Beethoven died, at the age of 56, much too young, is so rich and varied that a few phrases of characterization simply won't do. Dozens, if not hundreds, of biographies, as well as studies of the works themselves, fill the bookshelves of our music libraries. The last and perhaps best of these overall life and work books by Professor Maynard Solomon is 400 pages. I have it here. Now, when the remarkable pianist and psychiatrist, Dr. Richard Cogan, returns to us on October 22nd, he will not only play three Beethoven sonatas from different parts of his life, but discuss what most of us know about that composer's unimaginable affliction, his deafness from his late 20s on. How the young composer, who of course had heard music clearly since his youth and his early studies, came to grips with this incredible blow of fate, considered the worst thing that can befall a musician, will surely be among the main topics of Dr. Cogan's presentation. It is an extraordinary instance of mind over matter, a triumph wrested from disaster. Dr. Kogan's lecture recital, as you know, is entitled Beethoven, His Mind and His Music. And this remarkable performing artist and practicing psychiatrist knows a great deal about both. We shall talk about the artistic effects of deafness on this composer a little later. But I should remind you that a good musician does not require actual sound to hear a score in his mind when he or she sees it on the page. The more experienced that musician is, the more a score, even an orchestral one, with 27 staves, will be audible in his mind's ear. Our distinguished guest, Lewis Lane, who is with us today, can tell you about that, reading a score and hearing the sound. And when a composer writes down his music, he actually hears it too, as the notes appear on the paper. Furthermore, if I know a symphony very well, from many hearings over the decades, I can reproduce it in my inner hearing almost completely. I can play it for myself mentally. Yes, the continuity will at times be broken, but one just goes on to a spot a few measures later. It can be done. If we are at all musical, we've had the experience of a tune going on in our heads over and over like a tape loop until it almost drives us crazy. How to get rid of it? Well, quickly listen to something else. Maybe the tape loop will finally tear. I'm delighted to tell you that the September issue of Harvard Magazine features a long article about Dr. Kogan's work under the amusing title of Sonatas from Syndromes. If you don't already subscribe to that very valuable magazine, you can certainly find a copy in your library, Harvard Magazine of September. I have a few copies lying here. Dr. Kogan is quoted as saying, "In many primitive societies, the roles of physician and musician are played by the same person. Sometimes they use medical instruments, sometimes musical instruments, reaching into the doctor's bag to pull out either an herbal treatment or a harp." And he reminds us that in ancient Greece, Apollo was the god of medicine as well as music. So what is left for me to do is to remind you of some basic data of Beethoven's life and times, and to offer you a few examples of his enormous output that might illumine his style or mode of expression, the variety of which he offered us over 40 years of active work. And I may be able to give you a few insights into the music that Dr. Kogan will perform for us. Now, the biographical data of Beethoven's life are really not particularly adventurous. He lived essentially in two places and rarely traveled far from them, very much unlike Mozart and Haydn, whose journeys took them as far as London, in Mozart's case also to Italy and France at a young age. Beethoven, once he had settled in Vienna at the age of 23, traveled mostly between apartments, in fact several dozen times, because his landlords and landladies were eager to throw him out. He was messy, argumentative, and he played the piano loudly day and night. Yes, in 1812, at the age of 42, he did vacation in northern Bohemia, where he met his idol Goethe, the greatest German poet and author of Faust and Egmont, a place called Teplitz in Bohemia. Beethoven was born in 1770 in the old, beautiful Rhineland city of Bonn to become Germany's capital for a while after World War II. Beethoven was of Flemish background. His grandfather, whose name of Ludwig he inherited, was a singer at the court chapel. And his son, Johann, Ludwig's father, young Ludwig's father, succeeded him there, but soon became a victim to the old demon alcohol in the form of good Rhenish wine. Johann's attempt to produce another Mozart in his evidently gifted son did not succeed. Even as a child, Ludwig was hard to teach or even to control. He had a mind of his own, and what a mind it turned out to be. By his early teens, he was already renowned for his gifts as a pianist and composer, and when he was 13, his first compositions were published. He was appointed to more and more important posts by the local prince, Maximilian Franz, who in 1787 sent the 17-year-old youngster to Vienna to study with Mozart. Now, the Viennese master was impressed by Ludwig's talent, may have even given him a lesson or two. But because of Ludwig's mother's final illness, the boy had quickly to return to Bonn. When Haydn returned from his first London sojourn through Bonn in 1792, he was shown some scores by the young composer and invited him to come study with him in Vienna. Armed with recommendations from Count Waldstein, whose name was to grace a later piano sonata, Beethoven quickly established himself in the imperial capital as pianist, brilliant improviser, and promising composer. It was clear that before he reached the age of 25, he was a musical personality to reckon with. His lessons with Haydn, however, were not highly productive, since the young man had ideas of his own and did not take kindly to criticism, a trait that continued and increased. He remained, however, a genuine admirer of the old master, dedicating several of his early works to him. From the mid-1790s on, Beethoven produced his first two piano concertos, his six string quartets, opus 18, and numerous piano sonatas, one of which we shall hear on October 22nd from the accomplished fingers of Dr. Kogan. Beethoven's career seemed assured. His position in the world's musical capital was secure. His renown spread widely. For a time, he made his name as a traveling virtuoso, not going very far, reaping acclaim in Prague and Berlin for his extraordinary improvisations at the keyboard. But then that career came gradually to an end. In his later 20s, catastrophe struck him, like a thunderbolt from a jealous and vindictive Zeus. He was losing his hearing. By the turn of the century, he could no longer hear all high-pitched sounds. His tendency to moroseness increased, and his defensive and uncommunicative behavior alienated many. Now, the causes of that affliction have been widely studied and discussed. They seem to have been physiological entirely, but they certainly contribute to the evident changes in his personality. Dr. Maynard Solomon, in his outstanding Beethoven biography of 1977, writes that the composer's own explanations and self-justifications were oversimplified. He claimed, for example, that after his death, the world will become reconciled to me, and will understand why I was regarded as malevolent, stubborn, and misanthropic. The author responds as follows. Yet these traits in Beethoven's character existed long before the onset of his deafness. One of his friends, Frau von Breuning, was already familiar with his stubbornness and wayward moods in Bonn. His tendencies toward misanthropy and withdrawal were also evident in his earliest years, and patrons, teachers, and rival pianists had felt the force of his aggressiveness long before this time. Naturally, the consciousness of advancing deafness had a traumatic effect, but one senses that there is more at work here. One might also add that Father Johann von Beethoven's alcoholism may have played a role in the character development of the young genius. I think it was Mark Twain who said that he loved humanity. It was people he couldn't stand. He would have understood Beethoven very well. Most probably, Dr. Kogan will deal with these issues on October 22nd. But what concerns us as music lovers and listeners to his work is the effect that terrible affliction had and must have had on his creative work. First, however, both his health and his angry outlook on life resulted in his being unemployable in the usual 18th century tradition. Working as a schoolmaster or an organist choirmaster for a church, even as a kapellmeister for a local prince, as Haydn had been, was quite unthinkable. All this taken together forced Beethoven to become a self-employed, independent musician without any professional affiliation, what in German is called ein freischaffender Künstler, a freely creative artist, and he may have been one of the first to be such. Mozart was denied steady employment until it was too late, but Beethoven took this non-affiliation, took it on with a vengeance. For that, however, he needed the support of his friends and admirers in the aristocracy, men who provided him with stipends and gifts and commissions sufficient for him to make a living. The composer accepted that largesse with appreciation, but never let the donors forget that he deserved it all in spades. To one nobleman he said, "You are a prince because you inherited the title. I am a prince because I worked to gain such a distinction." The Vienna aristocracy didn't take that essentially as arrogance, but reminded themselves that, after all, he was Beethoven, and he needed to be indulged. History has proved them right. Who today would know the names of Prince Lobkowitz and Prince Lichnowsky and Count Kinsky, the Archduke Rudolf and Count Razumovsky, were it not for the patronage and sponsorship of Beethoven? It was a clear case of guilt by association, and the gift of gold was lavishly rewarded by musical masterpieces. Yet in that terrible blow to a musician, the loss of his hearing, there resides an extraordinary irony. And as Dr. Solomon so perceptively writes, there may be a sense in which deafness played a positive role in his creativity. For we know that it did not impair and may have even heightened his abilities as a composer, perhaps by permitting a total concentration upon composition within a world of increasing auditory seclusion. In his deaf world, Beethoven could experiment with new forms of experience, free from the intrusive sounds of the external environment. free from the rigidities of the material world, free like the dreamer to combine and recombine the stuff of reality in accordance with his desires into previously undreamed forms and structures, unquote, Dr. Solomon. I would take issue with a distinguished author on only one point. Quite free from the rigidities of the material world, he may not have been. He was always worried about money, about the next commission, the next contract with a publisher that struck him as not advantageous enough. He may not have been the most astute of businessmen, but he always made sure where the next gulden or ducat was to come from. And why should he not? In any event, his famous saying, "I shall seize fate by the throat," led in time to what was regarded as Beethoven's heroic style, the sense in his music of battling against obstacles, of overcoming them by sheer will, by aiming for a perfection that great artists always envision but cannot always reach. He knew who he was, and woe to the critic who did injustice to his work. His responses could not be only violent, but vulgar. He was not in the habit of talking through his hat. I will forego giving you an example of one of his responses. At the same time, we have to learn to separate his personal feelings at any one given time with the music he was writing at that time. In 1802, for example, when he produced that extraordinary document called the Heiligenstadt Testament, justifying himself to posterity about his personal sufferings, he wrote his Second Symphony, the sunniest, most outgoing, utterly positive music he had yet created. It was just like Tchaikovsky, who said that when, he said 90 years later, when he wrote the Pathetic Symphony, he never felt so cheerful. In a recent conversation, on the occasion of his 80th birthday, a tribute to the great guitarist B.B. King on Ted Koppel's Nightline, he said, "Some think I play the blues because I am blue." A good lesson. And then he confused the issue by continuing, "When I play the blues, I feel better." Now, wait a minute. That's yet another story. That's music therapy. In any event, no composer can sustain his personal mood during the long span of writing an extended work, especially an orchestral one. He simply knows what music will produce the emotional as well as formal and aesthetic result he wants to express. Yes, life and art are deeply and intimately interconnected, but they're not the same, and certainly not the same at the same time. Now, for all these reasons and causes, Beethoven broke the mold. Haydn and Mozart had, at the close of the 18th century, said that all there was to be said about what we now call musical classicism, the classical style in music. There was no way to match it or excel it. There had to be something different, something new. Beethoven had completely absorbed the style and language of his masters. Now he would break out with his own style, his own language. But it was not necessary to destroy what had been. It was only essential to add to it, to widen the playing field, to stride across set borders into new territory. Nobody said it better than the great German poet, his contemporary, Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, who said, "That which your forebears have bequeathed to you, now earn it so you may possess it. A beautiful saying. Was du ererbt von deinen Vätern hast, erwirb es, um es zu besitzen, is the original. Goethe and Beethoven, who knew and respected each other, thus became the avatars of what we now call the Romantic era. So there followed in 1803, he was 33, the first major symphonic work completely his own, the Eroica, the Heroic Symphony, in which the young master marches confidently into regions yet unexplored. And then some 20 more piano sonatas, 3 more piano concertos, the violin concerto, and before 1813, 10 years later than the Eroica, 5 more symphonies, numbers 4, 5, 6, the pastoral, number 7, number 8, each one different, indeed unique. Then there was a pause, a period in which the aging master rested before the final ascent, with the last piano sonatas, the last 5 of 16 string quartets, the Missa Solemnis, and the Ninth Symphony. How can we possibly sum up all this incredible, unfathomable creativity from a man more than ever closed off from the real world, lonely, increasingly eccentric, deaf as a post, unhappy and often ill? How did he manifest his indomitable will by taking up his single opera, Fidelio, 9 years after its early failure in 1805, to shape a new and vastly stronger version in 1814? His motto was never to give up, to work and, if needed, to fight the world to realize his artistic vision. Politically, Beethoven was what we would today call a flaming liberal, always standing up for the oppressed and the unjustly persecuted. That's what the opera Fidelio is all about. And then, in his 57th year, he dies of a variety of illnesses, including dropsy, or an extreme form of edema, liver and intestinal disease from which he had suffered all his life, and all that went with a body long abused by irregular lifestyle. Recent research claims that one of the conditions that contributed to so early a death, remember that Haydn had died at 77, was nothing other than lead poisoning. Recent examination of a lock of Beethoven's hair seemed to prove that hypothesis. The composer liked to sweeten his rather too sour wine with something called Bleizucker, lead sugar, a form of acetic acid. At that point, people didn't yet know the dangers of lead in all its form, including lead pipes and lead tableware. The composer's funeral was a public ceremony. The Viennese, who had long regarded the man as magnificent but half crazy, turned out to the tune of 30,000. It has been said that they should have listened to his music instead. Oh yes, they listened. But what did they hear? The vastly larger part of the public understood him as little as later generations did Wagner and Brahms and Bartok. 4 decades after Beethoven's death, Bizet observed that in Paris the Ninth Symphony was still a puzzle, and only a tiny minority could follow, to say nothing of enjoying, the last string quartets. Respecting and admiring a great creative figure was and is one thing. Making his work a part of one's own artistic life is a slow and often arduous process. true understanding of an artwork is almost never a matter of instant gratification. It needs work also on the part of the receiver. But what delightful work it can be. In the center's newsletter, my article on Beethoven, which you may have seen, quotes him to have said, "Composing is thinking in tones." So let us try for a while to follow his thinking, to work with him as a composition comes about. It's often observed that every composer has the same problem once he comes up with an idea. How to go on? How would we do it if we were composers and the musical thought had struck us? Now, the sonata with which Dr. Kogan will begin the set of three is an early one, numbered Opus 10, number 2. And it starts like this, as played in a moderate tempo on our home piano by my wife, Jean. Pum, pum, tum, ti-ti-ti-dim. Simple. In the classical tradition of the late 18th century, there will be a response to the statement like this. Good. Simple. Now, this is perfectly comprehensible to us as music. It needs no explanation, no analysis, no puzzling over. It says exactly what it means to say. But this instant attempt at symmetry is very much related to speech. We might compare it to a rhyme, these two parts. Beethoven often liked to play with musical themes as if they were words, a way of communicating with familiar speech. This beginning could be taken, "Oh, yes, that's what I said. Why, sure, that's what I meant." And he goes on to something else. He continues it before eventually returning to it, which he will. But even late in life, Beethoven liked to play such games. And in one case, he actually wrote words above the music, above the notes. When the finale of his last string quartet, Opus 135, begins, we hear such a speaking idea. But this time, it is much more extended and large, made significant and portentous. What's this all about? Musically, we understand what he's doing, but there's a story behind it. And the story is that Beethoven had an argument with somebody who wanted to borrow a set of musical parts. And the composer insisted that he should be paid for such use. And more to amuse himself than to make a major issue of it, Beethoven decided to set the discussion to music, so to speak, by putting these words above the notes. Must it be? Must it be? And the delayed answer was, it must be, it must be. Now, listen to it again, with that in mind. Muss es sein? To have to stop at this point. Some, of course, have heard a much more profound statement here. Perhaps it is that as well. I mean, think of the concept of must it be? It must be. That could mean many things beyond the argument with the moocher. Now, it's not necessary to know all that to understand the music. The juxtaposition of a question with its reply is perfectly obvious without the words, but Beethoven did write words above that. It shows us that the composer, during all his career, found this game of human communication useful, the juxtaposition of statement and answer, a device that would make instant contact with listeners, just as Haydn and Mozart had shown him. That is known as tradition. In the best sense. Now, back to the early sonata. Having said humorously what he meant, he wouldn't continue with the same thing. He would instantly come up with a phrase that is in the same key, the same meter, but now new to us. This time, Anton Kurti plays it for you at a faster tempo. Then we come back to the initial motto, which differs in harmony, and right away picks up the rhythm of the answering fragment. In a moment he's off with yet another new idea, but it all hangs together perfectly logically. Thank you. after. Still something new. You see, two of the basic principles of writing music are there.